Hi, I'm Tess Vigeland. When you go to buy a house, you're supposed to know how much you're paying for everything the day you sign the papers. But the numbers at the start of the loan process and at the end are often very different.
The good faith estimate was pretty much the good faith guess. It really bore very, very little semblance to what you would finally see at the closing table.
We'll explain how new government rules are making it possible to put your faith in the home buying process. And maybe you used to read all the investment advice you could find. Now that advice seems better for lining the kitty box. Time to take on a little responsibility for yourself.
You have to have an opinion on something. I mean, you can't just blindly go out there and say, you know, hope for the best.
And when a couple says they're a perfect match, are they taking their spending habits into account? That story and more coming up on Marketplace Money from American Public Media. From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, this is Marketplace Money. I certainly hope the nation's junkyards are prepared for this. Who knew so many people had clunkers in the driveway and were just looking for an excuse to trade them in for a new car? Apparently, nobody knew. And the government has created a program that's so successful, it ran out of money. I'm Tess Vigeland. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivin Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit financial service provider helping its members take charge of their financial strategies and put today's market on their side. More at thrivin.com.
So you were planning to head out to the auto dealership this weekend looking for a little government-sponsored trade for that gas guzzler in the driveway. Then you heard that cash for clunkers was so popular that they had to suspend it. Scratch that. Go buy your car. They'll find a way to pay for it. Really. That's pretty much where we are. On Friday, the House allotted more money, and the Senate will vote next week. Meantime, Uncle Sam is urging you to keep those clunkers coming, if for no other reason than to give the government bragging rights to a program that, works. Our good friend Phil Reed of Edmunds.com is here with the latest. Hi, Phil.
Hi, Tess.
You've been a little busy the last 48 hours?
It's been a wild ride. Nobody could have predicted that this would happen, I don't think.
I don't think so. Well, obviously nobody predicted this would happen. You know, this thing is basically less than a week old. You do the math on a $1 billion program with $4,500 rebates, and that's something like, what, 250,000 cars traded in already?
Well, yes, that would add up to a billion, but there's probably a lot of deals that are actually pending, so it's unknown. There could be far more than that already.
Wow. Can you give us an idea of what that means in the industry? Do they ever sell that many cars in a week?
It's definitely a big spike in terms of sales. The question is, how long will it last? Now, if it lasts at its current rate, it will put us on track for about, I think it's 12 million or 13 million cars. Now, in the good old days, just a couple of years ago, they used to sell 16 million cars per year. So we're getting back to where that used to be. But if it sort of goes back in the other directions, we'll probably wind up this year selling about 10,000 or 11,000 cars.
Well, then what does this tell us about the pent-up demand for cars in this country?
I think it sends a clear signal that given a good reason to buy a car, people are ready to take the plunge. And that's, I think, exactly what the program was designed to do, because in terms of numbers, as you pointed out, it's really not going to solve all of the problems that they have out there. But it shows people, first of all, this is a program that works, and secondly, that there is a pent-up demand of people waiting for the right reason to go out and buy a new car.
Well, so you say the program works. What are you hearing about the process, both for consumers and for dealerships? Has it been fairly easy?
The process is definitely not user-friendly. It's probably a little easier for consumers than it is for the dealers. The consumer needs to first of all find out, do I qualify? Once they qualify, you need to find a replacement vehicle. A lot of people think they qualify and they don't, so you have to go to fueleconomy.gov and make sure you get 18 miles per gallon or less. That's a good starting point. As far as the dealers go, I was actually in New York this week talking to dealers, and they were just deluging us with questions about the mechanics of the program. Many of them are very detailed, and they pertain toward the titling and insurance of the cars, but there's also a lot of unknown questions about how to dispose of the trade-ins. The car has to be basically rendered inoperable, but then once you do that, how do you salvage the car, and who gets the money from that? So there's lots and lots of questions.
You know, I joked about this a little earlier, wondering if junkyards were ready for this.
Everybody's been watching this coming, and people that are going to profit from it in terms of money have been trying to arm themselves and be prepared. And clearly, deals are going through. In other words, I mean, they've almost used up the money. So some people have navigated a very sort of labyrinthian process. Meanwhile, a lot of people are very vocal with questions.
This was meant not only to help jumpstart the auto industry, but also to get more fuel-efficient cars on the road. Is there any sense yet of what consumers are buying when they trade in their clunkers?
That's a great question, and we have been getting reports of inventory levels that are definitely diminishing, and that means that some of the very highly fuel-efficient cars, particularly like, for example, in the Toyota lineup, are getting to be hard to find, and that's partly because production levels were cut way back, and there's probably going to be less and less to choose from as we go forward.
So I hate to ask this, but does that potentially mean that prices are going to go up?
Well, that's been a huge discussion this week. We've been getting lots of feedback from consumers who were in the middle of a deal when the Cash for Clunkers was approved and funded. They went back. They thought they had a set price for the vehicle. One consumer reported, well, the price was suddenly raised $1,100. Other people are saying that dealers are telling them flatly, you have to buy at sticker price in order to qualify for this program. So clearly, we felt that the price was going to go up, but a lot of people feel that this is an opportunity for dealers who were, you know, coming hat in hand for any deal previous to this to suddenly begin gouging.
All right. Phil Reed of Edmunds.com, thanks for coming and checking in on the Cash for Clunkers program with us.
My pleasure. Good talking with you.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit financial service provider helping its members take charge of their financial strategies and put today's market on their side. More at thrivent.com. And by Thomson Reuters, a source of intelligent information to businesses and professionals around the world. Thomson Reuters, knowledge to act.
We all knew we'd be spending a lot of time in the waiting room while politicians debate healthcare reform. We knew it meant open-heart surgery for the entire health industry. And now it seems infection is starting to set in. All we can do is pace and wish that health reform was as successful as Cash for Clunkers. Congress is getting ready to head home for August break with no clear deal on the table. So let's hear about one buzz phrase that came up this week. The idea is to tax so-called Cadillac or gold-plated benefit plans. Joel Rose explains what those are.
The average family's health insurance policy costs $13,000 a year. Some plans cost twice, even three times that much. Those are the plans the White House is talking about taxing. Here's presidential adviser David Axelrod on CBS's Face the Nation.
This was an intriguing idea to put an excise tax on high-end health care policies like the ones that the executives at Goldman Sachs have.
Goldman Sachs didn't return my calls, so I didn't get to ask exactly what a $40,000 a year health insurance plan covers. But Len Berman at the Tax Policy Center in Washington thinks he knows.
There are some plans for which almost everything is paid for. So you go to the doctor, you don't worry about what's prescribed or how much is being spent because you're not responsible for any of it.
You're not responsible for the proposed taxes either. They would be directed at insurers who offer premium plans, although insurance companies would probably just pass the costs back to the consumer. And a lot of those consumers aren't earning Goldman Sachs salaries. They're just paying high premiums because they may have a pre-existing condition or because they're expensive to insure for other reasons. Karen Politz studies the insurance industry at Georgetown University.
Insurers will jack up the price of health insurance for somebody who's sick. We pay more based on age, but that doesn't make it a Cadillac. It just makes it an overpriced, bicycle.
Unless there are cheaper plans on the market, Politz says the proposed tax might indirectly affect a lot of people with expensive but very average coverage. I'm Joel Rose for Marketplace Money.
We want to hear your concerns about health care. How is Congress addressing what matters to you? Go to Marketplace.org and share what you know. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. One of the most fundamental questions that came out of last fall's economic meltdown was, is my money safe anywhere? As our 401ks imploded and our banks teetered on the brink of collapse, we actually wondered if it was time to go to the mattresses. Money we had in the stock market simply vanished. Savings and checking accounts stayed safe, but another traditionally safe haven failed us. And in this week's Straight Story, economics editor Chris Farrell says it's time to say bye-bye to the money market mutual fund.
The other day I had some extra savings. It's money I can't afford to lose. Over the past 3 decades, I would have put it into my money market mutual fund without even thinking. Yet I sent the money to my bank savings. I had closed my money fund earlier this year, and I won't open up another. The reason is that money market funds are no longer a safe enough parking place for cash. The industry doesn't want to acknowledge it. Regulators are trying to avoid the issue. Yet for many conservative savers, it's simply too risky a product. It's hard to imagine now, but the money fund was one of the great innovations from the age of inflation. In the late 70s and early 80s, it was the hottest investment for middle-class savers. Regulations at the time prevented banks from offering savers anything over 5.25%, but market interest rates were at double-digit levels. Money funds could pay those rates, 11%, 12%, and so on. Longtime financial journalist Joseph Nocera says the question at the time wasn't, do you dare to risk your money in such a fund? It was, how could you not risk your money in a fund? In 1980, investors had poured $84 billion into money funds. 2 years later, that sum had swelled to $200 billion. Money funds gradually evolved into a staid investment haven for cash. The industry pledged that a dollar invested in a money fund would be worth a dollar no matter what. It worked for a long time. That is, until the fall of last year. The industry broke its word during the darkest days of the credit crunch. When money market fund values started falling below a buck, taxpayers had to rescue the industry. You can't trust the money fund. We won't break a buck pledge anymore. How do we know our savings won't vaporize during the next financial crisis? We don't. The money in a fund is at risk. Yes, I know the SEC has proposed several changes to boost investor confidence, but these are minor reforms. There are good ideas out there. Jane Bryan Quinn, the Dean of Personal Finance Journalists, recently got to the core of the issue. She called for a dramatic overhaul of the business. Money funds that want to say a dollar is a dollar should become like banks with government insurance. Funds that don't want to go that route should say share values will fluctuate. There's nothing wrong with that. Just make it clear that there's a speculative element to the investment. It's frustrating that once again the interests of consumers and savers aren't front and center with Wall Street regulators and industry leaders. For now, I trust the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation. I know my emergency savings are guaranteed even if my bank goes belly up. The same can't be said for money funds. That's why I've decided to label money funds the caveat emptor product of the week.
Chris Farrell with this week's Straight Story. He'll be back in a bit to take your questions. Thousands of families use food stamps to buy groceries, but first, they have to get over the stigma.
Because if you really stop and think about it, it's not only you, it's other people out there using it, but you think that, oh, maybe it's only me.
Listen in as a single mom navigates the system. Next on Marketplace Money from American Public Media. You know, to me, investing is akin to one of those awful SAT word problems. You know, a train traveling west at 60 miles per hour, another train traveling east at 70 miles per blah, blah, blah. I have a headache already. Well, the stock market equivalent, I think, goes something like this. Economic recovery is likely if X equals Y minus two-thirds the unemployment rate. Deeper recession is likely if Y equals sugar cubes and pigs fly. I came across a couple of word problem-like articles this week that basically made my head explode. So, we asked Wall Street Journal columnist Jeff Opdyke to come in and explain his piece, which starts like this. Inflation or deflation? Even the experts can't agree whether rising or falling prices lie in our future. I asked him, why not just stop right there?
You know, this gets to something I've been trying to address a little bit in my, quote, new coverage. You know, I've been writing personal finance for 16 or so years. And one of the things that I think is kind of missing is an open-ended approach to reporting personal financial news and investment news. You know, you often end up with stories that are, okay, this person says it's inflation, so we're going to write this story about inflation. And somewhere in the body of the story, we're going to throw, you know, a paragraph or two in there that says, to be sure, you know, it could be deflation. And if so, then all bets are off. Mm-hmm. You know, and I wanted to say, wait a minute, you know, let's realize first off that the folks who think it's going to be inflation are wrong, and the folks who think it's going to be deflation are wrong. Nobody knows what it's going to be. They're all guessing. So the best thing you can do is basically build a portfolio that is designed to do okay, you know, no matter what happens. And that's the way it should have always been. Unfortunately, it hasn't always been that way, and I kind of wanted to bring it back to that.
So this is all advice for people who are still in the market. What is your current advice for all those folks who, after last fall, after the economy collapsed, the stock market collapsed, just said, you know what, I'm done?
I would caution them to step back and unemotionally view that statement, because investors, individual investors, and even pros, I got to say, have a habit of being very, very giddy and excited at the top of the market and think it can only go higher, and they're pumping all their money into it. And then when it cracks and goes to the bottom, they hold on and hold on and hold on and just pray and hope and, you know, do all kind of rain dances to try and get the market to go back up.
Can we have you demonstrate one of those on our website? That would be great.
and then the market hits bottom, and that's it. I'm done with the stock market. I don't want anything to do with this anymore. And what they've done is completely the opposite of what they need to be doing. They should have been very cautious at the top, and they should be getting increasingly more optimistic at the bottom.
Right.
In times of displacement like we've had, in its wake is going to be left a lot of really good companies, a lot of really good bonds, a lot of really good, you know, whatever in that asset class. Now is the time to sort of look for those opportunities that exist in the market.
I guess the question there, though, really is, how much knowledge do you have to make all of those decisions, to, you know, look at different asset classes and decide which one is going to work for you and which one isn't?
That answer goes across a very, very broad spectrum from, you know, you don't need a whole lot of knowledge to you need an MBA. You know, it just depends on what kind of asset class you're talking about. You know, when I'm talking about opportunities, I'm talking about the opportunities that the average investor has access to information. You know, potentially the real estate market, that is the stock market, that is, you know, the corporate bond market and the local muni bond market in your particular state or hometown. But again, gets back to that same sort of overriding point, which is you have to have an opinion on something. I mean, you can't just blindly go out there and say, you know, hope for the best. You kind of sort of look at your own personal life, your own personal experiences, and you take a side.
And so what you're saying when you tell people, you know, decide whether you think there's going to be inflation or deflation is that no matter which way you go, no matter how you kind of try to predict the future, you have to protect yourself on the backside.
Right. It's like that with everything in life, you know, and that's sort of the genesis of that story is you got to be out there. You have two choices as an investor these days. You can stick to cash and hope for the best, or you can put your money to work and hope for the best. And I know that sticking in cash, you know, may be safe, but it's not going to generate the return over time that you want. I mean, most people want their money to go to work for them. And if you want your money to go to work for you, that means investing. You have to make a decision as an investor. Do I believe in scenario A? Do I believe in scenario B? Or scenario C, as the case may be. Pick one of those and then determine what the opposite case could possibly be and invest a little bit on the side for that as your insurance policy, maybe 10 or 15% of your portfolio built in as insurance so that, you know, if A, B, and C is wrong, you've got something behind you to provide that protection.
And then if you guess inflation and we have rampant inflation, you look like a genius.
Exactly.
Jeff Opdyke is a personal finance and investments reporter for The Wall Street Journal. He's got a new blog starting there in a few weeks. Jeff, we'll look forward to that. Thanks for coming on the show again.
Hey, appreciate it. Thanks a lot.
My
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit financial service provider helping its members take charge of their financial strategies and put today's market on their side. More at thrivent.com. And by saveandinvest.org, helping military service members and families manage their money with confidence by providing unbiased financial information, tools, and more. Online at saveandinvest.org.
It's hard for most of us to imagine not having enough money for food. But the number of people qualifying for food stamps is up 20% over this time last year. These days, they're not actually stamps. The government benefit comes in the form of a plastic debit card, and it goes by the peppy acronym of SNAP, Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program. More retailers, including Costco, are working toward accepting the cards. So to see just how far food assistance goes, we sent Marketplace's Jeff Tyler shopping with one recipient in Southern California.
Buying groceries isn't one-stop shopping for Maribel Diaz. She crisscrosses town to get the most bang for her benefit bucks, starting here at the farmer's market in Pasadena.
Hi.
Good morning.
How you been?
Okay.
I want to use my EBT card so I could buy some vouchers.
Diaz hands the woman her EBT card. EBT stands for Electronic Benefit Transfer. The old paper food stamps are out. Plastic is in. It looks and works like a debit card.
On a monthly basis, they put a certain amount, depending on my income, in my card.
The amount also depends on the size of the family. Diaz is a single mom with three boys.
So this month I got $400. Let's go shopping.
She moves from one stall to the next.
Could I get a cabbage?
With or without leaves?
Ooh, with leaves. With.
Among other things, she buys spinach, beets, oranges, and strawberries. Altogether, she spends $28. Then Diaz loads up her car and drives to East Los Angeles, where she'll do more bargain hunting at a supermarket called Superior Warehouse. She's been receiving food assistance for about 8 years.
I was out of state, and then I came back. And then ever since then, it's kind of been, like, hard to get on my feet because basically I got here with nothing. Plus, I have three kids. So going to school and have not having someone to pick them up, I could basically only, like, deal with part-time jobs.
She has two part-time jobs, one with a nonprofit called Hunger Action and another at a convention center. The number of hours varies. Because she never knows exactly how much she'll make, Diaz has learned to be a savvy shopper. She walks into the store and immediately picks up the in-house flyer to see what's on sale. She fills her grocery cart with peanut butter, eggs, cereal, and yogurt, but she'll wait to buy tomato sauce at the next store.
There's some deals that are better here and then some at Food for Less. That's why I shop around at both stores.
Now, are there any things that you would normally shop for that aren't covered by food stamps?
The only thing that I do get that it's not covered is like the detergent, you know, stuff like to go wash, toilet paper, napkins.
Cigarettes and liquor aren't covered either. Same goes for pet food. At the checkout register, anything not covered by the SNAP program gets tallied separately, but all her groceries qualify. Diaz swipes her card. Even though it looks like a debit card, she says first-timers can feel self-conscious.
If your neighbors see you at the store, you kind of get embarrassed.
Over time, she says, people adjust.
Because if you really stop and think about it, it's not only you, it's other people out there using it. But you think that, oh, maybe it's only me.
In fact, 32 million people get help through the SNAP program. And a good number of them have beaten us to the next stop, a few blocks away at the Food for Less. Diaz can't find the frozen broccoli she's after. The shelves in the frozen section have been picked clean.
You know, from the 1st to the 10th, everybody gets their food stamps, so the markets are run out of a lot of produce. So normally I know they stock every Wednesday because I've asked the manager before. So if I do really need it, like I'll be back like Thursday morning.
Most of the food she buys is nutritious, with a few exceptions.
I know it's bad, but I had to get some bacon. But I know it was on sale. And I'm going to have some company this weekend, so might as well.
She stocks up on a variety of stuff, including a big jar of tomato sauce. So how much did she spend at the three markets?
Altogether, it adds up to like $230.
out of $400.
Do you normally spend more than half on the first day?
Yeah, it's normal for me to spend like $230 to $300. That's what I normally spend on the first day.
And she's not finished. Diaz will stop at two more stores to get cut-price meat and fish. She'll go shopping again in a week or so and use what's left of her monthly assistance.
If I run out, you know, I have to go to food banks and get, like, canned stuff. And there's some churches that you go to and they give you fresh produce.
How often does that happen?
I mean, this past year, I've gone, like, for 6 months straight, you know, to food banks and to churches because my food stamps were not enough.
Perhaps the acronym SNAP is a better name than food stamps. For many families, the assistance money goes just like... In Los Angeles, I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace Money.
A lot of things in this world are better when they're faster. The internet, visits from the in-laws. But faster isn't always better, especially when you're making one of the most important financial decisions of your life, buying a home. Well, as of this weekend, a new set of rules is in effect that's supposed to slow down the often frantic pace of home loan signing. It's also supposed to help make sure that you know the real price of things before you buy. Imagine that. Elizabeth Razzie has written a couple of Bibles on home buying, and I asked if this means those so-called good faith estimates will be based on more than faith.
Well, in the past, the good faith estimate was pretty much the good faith guess.
Right.
It really bore very, very little semblance to what you would finally see at the closing table because there were no repercussions if things changed.
This is the form that tells you everything from what your loan is going to cost to what you're paying for your loan servicer to do faxing for you. I mean, it's everything. It's title fees. It's all that sort of thing, right?
Yeah, it's an estimate of all those expenses, the title fees, as you said, and there's a laundry list, and that includes some things that are derided, and rightfully so, like faxing fees and paper handling fees and that sort of thing. They are always supposed to be listed on the good faith estimate, but often they would change. Now, within 3 days of applying for a mortgage, you're supposed to get a good faith estimate of those costs. Closing can only be 7 days after the lender has given you those disclosures. So you can't get rushed. You can't get your document and, all right, here's your disclosure and closing's at 3 o'clock. See you then. That's not going to be happening.
So how far will this go to help alleviate the problem that we heard so often over the last year or two where people simply said, I didn't understand my mortgage. I didn't know what was going to happen with my payments. Will this make it so that it is abundantly clear to everyone what is happening over the years with their mortgage?
Not by itself. You know, there's a big rush in Washington right now to be the consumer protector.
Yeah.
But there are many layers of things happening here. There's another effort underway to make the disclosures much more simple. There's talk about making sort of a standard loan, you know, government certified plain vanilla one.
Right.
That's all still in the works. But on the other hand, you can disclose all day long and some people just are not going to pay attention to it.
Let me ask you about another issue that's come up, and that is there's a new appraisal system that is underway to find out exactly how much your house is worth and whether the bank is going to bankroll your loan. And I've read that this new appraisal system is also putting a delay on things. Do you know about that?
Oh, this is a big, big issue. And it's not really clear who to believe.
Hmm.
The idea is that appraisers should be a step removed from the transaction. You know, during the boom years, I heard a lot of appraisers complain that they were getting pressured from lenders to make sure that they came in with values that were high enough to support the deal.
Right.
And these new rules are designed to eliminate that influence. Now, so the people who used to like the old way are really squawking loudly about it. It requires a third party to assign the appraisal job, you know, call up Joe Appraiser and say, I want you to do this job, you know, across town. Real estate agents are complaining loudly that a lot of appraisals are based on the wrong houses, you know, that one neighborhood is not necessarily like a neighborhood that's very close by geographically, or that they rely too much on foreclosures, And it's hard to tell how much of that is just resistance and how much is really a breakdown in the news system.
What is the best way for a consumer to try to keep track of all of these changes that are going on in the home buying and selling area? I mean, it really is dizzying. And if you were expecting it to be the way it used to be, it's really not anymore.
It's not at all. I mean, it's tough for us who write about this for a living to keep track of all of the changes that have come and how the changes interact with each other. The best way a buyer can or a seller can deal with this is to really know your finances. It's not a time for anything sloppy about, oh, I forgot to keep up on that account, or I forgot about that credit card account.
Yeah.
Dot all the I's, cross the T's, get your credit scores, all that, you know, brush your teeth advice. You have to do that now. And really keep track of the people who are working for you, the real estate agents, the appraisers, the home inspectors. It's a really important time to get somebody who's really on their game. And that's about all you can do right now.
Elizabeth Razzi is the author of The Fearless Home Buyer and The Fearless Home Seller. Thanks so much for joining us again.
Oh, you're welcome.
This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. Americans are not happy consumers these days. Really? That bit of obviousness brought to you by the Consumer Federation of America. We could have told them that ourselves based on the letters you send every week. Anyway, the CFA released a not quite Letterman-worthy top 10 list this week, and boy, are we fuming over our credit cards and mortgages. Topping the list, complaints about those companies promising to repair your bad credit. People, you can do this yourselves. You are also peeved over efforts to modify loans, probably because it's not happening much. Same with those promises to help you avoid foreclosure. Strong-arm debt collection tactics are also on the rise, and lots of folks filed complaints about unused gift cards that weren't honored and unfulfilled warranties when a business went under. Where is that new Consumer Financial Protection Agency when you need it? On hold. After helping thousands of business owners overseas, the microlending site Kiva.org is now open to U.S. businesses. But this is not a traditional investment.
It's not about earning a rate of return. It's about more effective philanthropy.
The whys and hows of microlending are coming up on Marketplace Money from American Public Media. Microfinance has been around for several years now. In 2006, Muhammad Yunus won the Nobel Peace Prize for his work providing tiny loans to businesswomen in poor areas of Bangladesh. Now there are lots of ways for individuals to lend to entrepreneurs around the world. One of those is through Kiva.org, the first online microlender. In its first 4 years of existence, Kiva loaned only to businesses outside the U.S. But this year, it announced the start of online lending stateside. Premal Shah is the president of Kiva.org. And Premal, let's start with how you go about getting a loan through Kiva.
To qualify for a loan in the U.S., there's kind of three criteria. First is it needs to be for a business purpose, the loan. It can't be for personal use. Second, you need to be able to demonstrate a capacity to repay. And then third, you need to have been declined by a bank when you ask for a small loan, or you clearly don't meet the requirement. And, you know, right now,
that's happening a lot.
It's happening a lot. In fact, yeah. You know, to get a little technical here, if you have a FICO score below 750, it's very hard to get a loan for your small business.
Are you concerned at all that opening up to recipients in the U.S. could dilute the money that's currently going overseas?
This is something that the staff of Kiva was really concerned about. You know, I think one way to think about this is when a store starts adding other things to, you know, their shelves, ideally you're still going to buy bread, but you might also buy milk as well. And hopefully there, more people will actually start lending on Kiva as a result of more choice. And ultimately, it's up to you. You know, when you go to the website, if your values kind of tell you that you want to lend abroad because you feel like there's a greater impact, that's absolutely up to you.
Well, let's talk about what lenders get out of this effort. First of all, can you tell us a little bit about how things are going for lenders? What's the rate of repayment?
after 3.5 years, 500,000 people have made a loan on the Kiva website, and that amounts to $75 million. That's funded about 180,000 entrepreneurs in almost 50 developing countries, and now the 51st country is the United States. And the repayment rate is right now 98.2%. To put that in perspective, consumer credit cards here in the United States, the repayment rates are around 94%. Hmm. And then, you know, microfinance in the United States, the nonprofit microfinance institutions that we decided to partner with, they experience about a repayment rate of 90%. So we think the repayment rate might drop a little on the Kiva website with some of the U.S. loans, but not significantly. And it's cool to be able to, you know, lend, help someone, and at least get some money back.
One thing that you don't get back under this program is any sort of interest. I remember a couple of years ago when we first profiled your organization, there was some debate about that, and there were some talks going on with the IRS. Any developments there?
It's not about earning a rate of return. It's about more effective philanthropy. It's not a, you know, a handout. It's a hand up, and you get to invest in their business as a business partner. And if you get your money back, then you can relend it to someone else or withdraw that money. That seems to satisfy a lot of people. And to date, you know, one of the big problems at Kiva is occasionally we run out of loans for people to fund.
Really?
Yeah. The internet community and word of mouth spread about Kiva is pretty phenomenal. And so what happens is, you know, the internet traffic on our site is scaling almost kind of parabolically, where our ability to go and find good, high-quality microfinance institution partners around the world and to vet them, that's only scaling linearly. So it's taking us a little while to actually build, you know, a good base of entrepreneurs for the internet community to fund.
Do you see microlenders eventually competing with banks on a larger scale?
You know, right now, the macro picture is something like 10% of those who actually need access to loans who are unable to access it from traditional commercial banks are being reached today. So there's a long ways to go. The bigger problem is that, you know, people, there's just not enough capital and there's not enough capacity of these local organizations to reach enough of these entrepreneurs around the world. So I think it's going to be a while before the banks feel any threat from the local microfinance institutions.
Premal Shah is the founder and president of Kiva.org, and we'll have a link to their website on ours. It's marketplace.org. Thanks so much for coming in today.
Thank you.
And as I mentioned, we first profiled Kiva back in 2007. You'll find that story and links to other microlenders at marketplace.org.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit financial service provider helping its members take charge of their financial strategies and put today's market on their side. More at thrivent.com. And by Gather.com, the social network where people can make new friends who share their interests. People talking about today's news at news.gather.com.
Folks giving through Kiva and other microlending websites eventually expect to get their money back. But plenty of people are looking to help without expecting anything in return. If you've ever offered financial assistance to friends or family, you know how hard it is to push through the, oh no, I can't take money from you, part of the process. Lisa Napoli tells us there is a new way to give anonymously to friends and family who need help but are too proud to accept it from someone they know.
Lionel Thompson and his wife Misha know well what it's like to be strapped for cash and unable to pay the bills, and to be on the receiving end of unexpected generosity.
One time, one of our neighbors gave us $1,000 to pay our rent. We went through a real difficult economic time, and it lasted for at least a year. But we had neighbors that got to know us that really came and they helped us.
Once they stabilized financially, Lionel and his wife made a pact. They'd make it possible for people to give money to friends who needed it without the awkwardness of a face-to-face exchange. So, with the help of some web designers, they built and run the website they call Giving Anonymously, where you can do just what the name suggests.
Thank you to whoever sent this. I really appreciate your help.
This woman named Jessica got an unexpected $150 in the mail to help her and her kids. She called the Giving Anonymously phone line to leave a message of thanks.
I went shopping and filled the house with produce and other food staples that maybe have been kind of put off or neglected lately. I wish I could thank you in person, but whoever you are, you obviously know me well enough to know that I probably wouldn't be accepting this from you.
Here's how giving anonymously works. You enter contact information about the person you want to help and how much you want to give. Then you enter your credit card information. Giving anonymously cuts a check and sends it to your friend. They're asked to leave a voicemail that's forwarded to the donor to verify that the gift was received.
We were very surprised and touched.
Mike and his family in Texas lost nearly everything in a hurricane and haven't been able to return home. He received a check for close to $1,800.
We intend to spend the money on things that we use daily so that we can constantly be reminded about how fortunate we are to have such wonderful friends.
That little act of kindness that we were able to facilitate was a real encouragement for that family there.
Lionel Thompson says he hears that all the time from people who receive gifts. They're so curious about which of the people they know could have sent them money that they're extra nice to everyone around them. Thompson says for the donors, this is different than sending a check to your favorite nonprofit organization.
We're not the charity. You're the charity. Look around your friends and family members in need, and you give to them.
Thompson says he and his wife, Misha, get very emotional when they listen to the voicemail thank yous, like this message from a mom named Crystal.
I received $300, and my thank you message is, this is so wonderful. I just sat in the pharmacy line picking up my daughter's $300 prescription. Thank you so much.
Giving Anonymously is an all-volunteer project. The Thompsons and the web company they work with all donate their time to make it possible. It's their way of acknowledging the kindness they themselves have received. I'm Lisa Napoli for Marketplace Money.
It's time for Getting Personal, the part of the show where we answer your questions. And our economics editor, Chris Farrell, is here with me to answer your personal finance questions. And we've got Tim on the phone from Memphis, Tennessee. Hi, Tim.
Hi, how are you?
Very well, thank you. And you?
Good.
Excellent. Well, I know that you wrote us an email saying that you've been following our advice, paying down your debt and building savings, but there is now a question mark.
Yeah, I have a question. Basically, I bought into the idea of having whole life about 5 years ago and convinced my wife about 3 years ago to also get a whole life policy.
Okay.
On the advice of a very persuasive representative, we now know that it's probably better to have term and not whole life.
Yep.
Right. However, what do I do with this whole life insurance policy?
The longer you own a whole life policy, all right, the more that cash value builds up, and you also can borrow against the policy, so it can be a source of low-interest loans. So I want to be very clear. I do not think that whole life policy is a bad policy, all right? But for many people, it can be an added expense that's just too much. And therefore, term is ideally designed for most people because what it does is it's relatively cheap, especially when you're young, and it protects your family.
So, Tim, how long have you had this policy?
I've had mine for 5 years.
And how old are you?
39.
So he does have a long time for it to potentially be profitable.
Absolutely. Now, I'm a little uncomfortable saying, hey, sell this policy, buy term. But what I do have is a suggestion for what I think is a very good service that will analyze the whole life policy for you and the question about term and give you an answer. And it's the Consumer Federation of America, which is a very good organization. It's a very good group. And I believe the cost for that evaluation is $75. That's a pretty good investment to get a sort of objective answer.
Yeah, I guess the analysis would be a very good benefit because it's a lot of number crunching that I'm not really willing to do. And I think $75 would be worth it.
I think it's worth it. Yeah.
All right. Well, good question. It was, I think, a good primer on whole life insurance as well. So thanks for the call.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. And next we have Mike with us. He is on the phone from Orlando, Florida. Hi, Mike.
Hi.
So what is your question for us today?
My question is, I'm finishing up my MBA, my executive MBA, and my company has been reimbursing me for approximately half the tuition. And I wanted to know whether I should pay off, do one lump sum payment, or if I should do something else with the money that I've been putting into a money market.
So did you do night school?
It's a Saturday MBA program. So I gave up the last year and a half of my Saturdays.
Wow, well, that is quite a sacrifice. I hope it works out for you in the end. What do you think, Chris?
Well, I have a couple reactions. First of all, I just think it's terrific that you're using the tuition reimbursement from your company. Mm-hmm. And this is one of the best benefits out there. I imagine, Mike, you paid a price in terms of lack of sleep.
Yes.
It's a really good company benefit, and most large corporations today offer it. And as far as I can understand, looking at the data, have maintained that benefit. They mm-hmm. haven't cut it like they have 401ks and that kind of thing. Here's the suggestion. Being out of debt, or at least being as close to out of debt as possible, is a really good thing in general. And in today's world, you know, the rate of return on paying down debt is almost always higher than what you can earn in the market. Look at the landscape and see what's going on in your life and whether or not you might need some savings just for additional flexibility. But once you know where you're going, boy, I'd just get rid of as much of the debt as possible.
Okay.
Well, congratulations and good luck.
Thank you.
Thanks for the call. And Chris, finally, I understand we have a bit of a correction to make regarding some advice that we gave a couple of weeks ago about wills. What's this all about?
Well, what it is, it's about the dangers of using loose language. And I use the term loosely joint will. And joint will turns out is a very specific term. So when a couple goes to talk to a lawyer, they each get their own will. It's essentially a mirror image of each other, but you each get your own will. And I use the term joint will. And that's actually a very specific product, which most people don't recommend.
All right. Well, that is unfortunately all the time we will have for Getting Personal this week. But you can give us a call anytime. The number is 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY. And we spell that M-O-N-Y. Or you can write to us through the Getting Personal link at marketplace.org. And there you will also find Chris's blog, where he's got all kinds of answers for you on all kinds of questions. Chris, thanks as always for the great advice.
Thanks a lot, Des.
This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. And finally, it is something of a cliche to say that opposites attract. You're introverted, he loves to go out. She likes dogs, you prefer cats. Tomato, tomato, and all that. But you can now bank on the fact that financial opposites attract. And in fact, if you're tight with money, that might be why you married your big spender spouse. Are you getting this, honey? It's all according to a study from a couple of professors, including Eli Finkel of Northwestern University.
We found that when looking at spending patterns, spendthrifts and tightwads tend to pair up.
And though singles say they would rather marry someone with spending habits like their own, they often don't. Finkel says it has a lot to do with trying to address the pain we each experience. Tightwads actually don't like spending too little money, and spenders don't really like spending too much.
On those rare cases where we have a trait about ourselves that we dislike, those might be the cases where we would seek somebody who's the opposite of us. So if I'm somebody who spends a great deal of money and experiences some pain about it, I'll dislike it enough in myself that I may well seek the opposite in a partner.
Of course, if you disagree on finances, the research also shows you may experience, quote, diminished marital well-being. We asked some married folks in Washington, D.C. and L.A. for their thoughts.
I'm more willing to spend on big ticket items that I think are worth it. He's always like, free, 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 if possible.
I spend money on things for the house, whereas he spends money on, like, games and entertainment.
My wife, she's a little more free with spending money, you know, because she likes to go with what I consider nice to have versus need.
He can be a little tight with money. I mean, not with me, but with other people, you know, getting presents, he's like, well, how much does that cost?
My pet peeve related to my spouse when she monitors how much I spend.
I
think that I'm a spendthrift.
And how about your spouse?
Taiwan.
Does that create some problems, tension?
It does. So a lot of times I get my way, though. So.
Why do you get your way?
Because my point of view is better, and I'm the woman.
Do you ever fight about money?
Yes, a lot.
And that's Marketplace Money for this week. Thanks for spending some time with us. Next time, if you have a car accident, should you take it to the body shop the insurance company recommends? Maybe not.
Go to the wrong place, and you could end up with anything under your hood. Lawnmower parts, garden hose, bits of someone else's car.
We have post-crash financial tips from none other than Cash Peters. Marketplace Money is produced by Deborah Clark with Stephen Hoffman and Eve Tro. Our technical director is Josh Rogerson. Our theme was composed by Mark Governor. The executive producer of the program is J.J. Yore. Remember, talk to your own expert before you make any big money decisions. I'm Tess Vigeland. We'll see you next week.
Want to hear something from Marketplace Money again? Help is as near as your home computer. To find audio archives of past programs and information on transcripts, just go to the internet and log on to our website. The information you need is only a few clicks away. Just point your browser to marketplace.org. Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit financial service provider helping its members take charge of their financial strategies and put today's market on their side. More at thrivent.com.
American Public Media.